Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing Jordan Peterson's latest crash out, which is something we've talked and documented a lot here on Evangelical Dark Web, because he's kind of been a major figure, but he's definitely lost a lot of favor over the years. And, you know, I think we've kind of explained it. I mean, you had your intellectual curiosity about Jordan Peterson and found him kind of wanting, you know.
Yeah, and
I'll let you elaborate on that real quick.
So it's part of it is because of when I probably was first introduced to Jordan Peterson, which I think was, 2022? And that was his appearance on Steven Crowder, which I thought was thoroughly unimpressive, especially since he is someone that was for years touted as, like, the guy. And then you see him, and he was just very underwhelming and honestly quite frankly disappointing. So I found him thoroughly unimpressive after that. And then, you know, you kind of just – so you never actually were enamored with him to be disappointed or disaffected to be in the first place. So I guess that's why we were probably a little earlier on the Jordan Peterson train. But even since then, nowadays, if you're out there touching grass and actually talking to, like, people at the conference scenes or whatever, you'll meet a lot of people who probably liked Jordan Peterson at one point, found him helpful, even personally helpful. And then they're asking themselves, what is going on with Jordan Peterson? Like, I know, you know, Christian Mario, who's, you know,
was it Mario or Mario?
Mario, whatever. Yeah, he's a, you know, former guest on the channel.
Yeah, at one point, once or twice.
And he actually had a tweet basically expressing this very thing. And then all the comments under the tweet were talking about how, you know, people that went to, like, Orthodox faith, you know, and he's Eastern Orthodox for those that don't understand, but yeah,
he appeared on our channel, I think.
Yes, he went after. But yeah, he's just him and, like, you know, 20 different commenters under his tweet were just like, yeah, you know, he helped me out, he led me back into religion. And a lot of people will credit Peterson with that. And then you have the direction that Peterson has taken now, which coincidentally correlates with his signing with the Daily Wire. And he's pretty much a Zionist mouthpiece.
Yeah, I think that's fair to call him that, because it, you know, there was always the, I don't want to say it's a meme, but he did a video on a message for Christians, a message for Muslims. He did not do one on a message for Jews. Kind of interesting that he had that sort of partiality very up front. And I think it's very much embedded. Now, there is another theory. You know, Charles Haywood blames his daughter, who's deaf, you know, who may, and probably did, have sex with Andrew Tate.
I mean, that's the allegations, which I think she would have been married at the time. I mean, again, Michaela Peterson is kind of a mess, and it is a kind of a stain on his reputation personally, just as it would be for any pastor who has a wayward child as an adult. And, you know, that's certainly the case with Jordan Peterson, that, you know, he talks about making his own bed, make your bed and all that, but his house is pretty disordered. And then when you look at her marriage, her remarriage, and her, and the timeline of when she professes Christianity, it kind of is a little questionable.
Yeah, we did a live stream on Michaela. Was it Mikhail? Michaela. Whatever. She's named after, I believe, Gorbachev, I think. That's what I'm hearing.
I mean, the spelling.
Because he has a very, you know, he has a, I guess, an affinity for Soviet Union, but which is kind of odd because, you know, I look at Russian history, I think Gorbachev was terrible. I think he was a terrible leader. But anyway, but apparently Jordan Peterson disagrees. So with that said, you know, the thought, you know, and Charles Haywood, past guest on the show, very based, by the way, Shampoo Warlord, he was saying that, yeah, when he saw, he was at a conference, she was leading him around by the nose or whatever. So he seems to think that Michaela Peterson's the reason for this.
I mean, people do
Daily Wire. I think
people do associate her with his benzo addiction problems, and they do say that they do presume that she has managed at some point his Twitter accounts. So yeah, the I guess proximity of Michaela Peterson to Jordan Peterson is certainly part of his brand problem.
Yeah, her rise in the podcast space, which she really has no real qualifications for, Well, not that anyone has qualifications to be in a podcast, but in terms of what she's done to have gotten the audience that she has, it is, what's the way to put it? It is showing off your plastic boobies on social media and being the daughter of Jordan Peterson. Like, that's, you know, your three reasons why she's famous. So with that said, that being attached to Jordan Peterson, his wagon is hitched to that. It does put a hit on the brand when your whole thing is about having your life in order and your own household was not in order. And that shows up.
Ironically, James Lindsay was trying to do the woke right goes after people's family. And as if that's, in this case, not a fair insinuation to connect the two, given that her career is tied to him, just as, you know, a lot of, like, you know.
It, just like Gavin Ortland's career is tied to Russell Moore. There are
or,
a topical
or Ray Ortland.
Or Ray Ortland, who was also bad. they're all hitched together in the same church.
Or Abraham Piper is not somehow connected or associated with, you know, John Piper. So, you know, there is an association there that can't be overlooked.
Right.
Or even that, like, Nala Ray got her father, I guess, made her father go astray in his pastorate.
And here's the thing. I don't think nepotism is inherently sinful. Because it's not. It is biblical to pass things down to your children and then your children's children. And thus, because someone's your child, they will get raised up in your ways, you know, learning a family business. So I don't think nepotism is inherently bad, even. It's, you know, order of loves, preference for your own children. And yeah, sometimes it can supersede meritocracy to some degrees. I mean, in the entertainment space, yeah, it's huge. It's huge. But Michaela Peterson, like, let's be real. I already gave the reasons why she's famous, because nepotism doesn't translate here. It doesn't. You have to have it in this media landscape specifically more than ever. It can give you, you know, it can give you a good start for sure, but you can get exposed real quick. And I don't think there's anything to it. We discussed the Michaela Peterson. Was it that interview that she did? Who was she interviewing that we were discussing?
What do you mean?
And we just described how apathetic she was towards faith matters. So anyway, we got Jordan Peterson, and this comes off the bat of two things on with his appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience. One is Douglas Murray's experience. And I already did a video talking about him trying to struggle session Joe Rogan. And that's what's going on here. Like, there's a campaign by these people that are liberals on the right, the actual woke on the right. There's a campaign by them to struggle session Joe Rogan because he's had guests on that they don't approve of. And Joe Rogan, he was famous for bringing people on that were counter to cultural narratives. He's famous for bringing people on from different perspectives. And here's the thing. But as soon as he brings people on that are anti-Semitic or whatever, that is when they have an issue with him.
Yeah, they don't care if they're like moon landing deniers or, you know,
alien.
They have weird theories about the pyramids, or they're just historical nut jobs. But yeah, the second they question a certain involvement with a certain country, that's when you get a lot of people that start, you know, going after Joe Rogan.
And one thing that's true is that Joe Rogan's increasing involvement with anti-Semitism is also tied and correlated with his increasing affinity for Christianity. Because if you go back in time, Joe Rogan was very anti-Christian. If you ever see his stand-up specials, like, he's very anti-Christian in them. And I'll be honest, like, yeah, I saw Joe Rogan at a stand-up special like a year or two ago, and it didn't look good at all. Like, I don't think he's good at stand-up, in my opinion. But he is very good at doing what else he does. You know, the Fear Factor, being the guy who invested everything in the UFC, and being a talk podcast host. Like, he's very good at those things. And probably also pretty decent at MMA. He might not be, you know, UFC level, but he's probably very good at that. So those are my thoughts, you know, and that's a correlation, I think, trends in American history. I think it's trending now. We're seeing a bro revival as well as an increase in anti-Semitism. I think those two things are very connected, especially when you look at the data that suggests that dispensationalism is dead and that majority of Republicans under 50 have a negative view of it, have an unfavorable view of modern Israel. Like, and now we're getting more Christianized. So I think that's, I think the two are very related because this is not a coincidence. Because a coincidence is when you notice patterns that you're not allowed to talk about. That's what a coincidence is. Anyway, let's get on to Joe Rogan. And you've seen this. I've not seen this. And that should make it a little bit more fun. What exactly is this clip? Is this the clip that's going around?
This is the clip that's going around. I mean, it might be various forms and various lengths, but this is about a 5-minute segment that is the pivotal clip that in which he tries to psychologize the right wing.
Yeah, the other thing I can't stand about Jordan Peterson is he loves the sound of his own voice a lot. So let's see how much that shines through here. Is he going to ask a question and then pontificate on the question and then re-ask the question? Like, he has a tendency to do that.
I mean, that's, yes, in the transcript, yes, he does do that.
Okay, let's go.
Institutional enhancement. And people who can't or won't do that, they default to power games. Mm. And the part of the, and that's a very, that's, yes, that's the default to power.
Right.
But it's worsened with social media.
Absolutely.
Because if you meet someone and they're playing a power game with you, you can just decide not to have anything to do with them anymore, or you can put a stop to it if you need to. But on social media, you can't, because they're distant from you and they're often also anonymous. Uh-huh. And so they can play power games to enhance their reputational status falsely with no consequences. And the social media is rife with that. And it's really a problem. Like, I think that virtualization has enabled the psychopaths.
Without a doubt.
So first thing that comes to mind here is this is a screed against Anons.
Yes.
And the thing about Anons is this is how we've taken the cultural vibe shift has been powered by Anons. It's not been powered by the Daily Wire. It's not been powered by Conservative Inc. And I'm not sure, it's not been powered by Big Eva, obviously. So who is it being empowered by? It's the Anons. It's the people on social media that make the memes, that make the left feel bad. And then these conservative podcasters really jump on board from social media conversations.
Well, and keep in mind, he's acting like, oh, it's some grand chess strategy that, you know, this random, you know, frog on the internet is somehow, you know, playing 4D chess against these massive influencers that can't seem to defeat them because it's like a game of whack-a-mole or something. But in reality, I mean, yeah, it was a guy named Captive Dreamer who basically got the entire country talking about Haitians in Springfield, Ohio. So yes, the power of Anons is
there
not
a time when Cat Turd was very influential.
Yes. So, I mean, the fact is that they're powerful because they don't actually have a face behind them. So it's not even like an individual's, you know, gaining popularity on their own accord. It's their ideas.
And they might have a good name.
Yeah, they might have a brand, but it's not necessarily tied to the person. So, I mean, he's trying to, again, suggest that these people are psychopaths, which, again, I think is unfounded. And, you know, I'm not really one to use a lot of these terms very loosely or flippantly, which, you know, kind of happens because we have a very psychologized lexicon.
I mean, that's Jordan Peterson's background and career. He's a Carl Jungian.
Yeah. So, I mean, and again, I mean, if you see why terms like empathy are very popularized in the culture, that's probably very much related to psychology.
I was going to say science fiction with the empaths and stuff like that. You know, like they have in Star Trek The Next Generation, Deanna Troi. Can't stand that character, but still.
Yeah, well.
Without a doubt.
That's a terrible thing because the psychopathic types, they're always the death of everything. Like, mm-hmm. I'm seeing this come up on the right now. So imagine this. I've been working on a new theory of political psychopathology, and I like it quite a lot.
Is this where the term the woke right comes in?
Yeah, well, Lindsay is pointing at that, but he hasn't got the diagnosis exactly right. So it isn't woke. That's not the issue. It's not exactly.
I think
one
what
level.
They're talking about is like similar types of behavior.
He is talking about that. Yeah, no, what he's pointing.
Woke just lets you clarify in your head, oh, it's like that.
Yeah, but the problem is.
It's like Antifa.
Yeah, absolutely. But the problem is that that argument is predicated on the claim that the ideas are the problem, like the woke ideas, for example, on the right or the left. But that's not the problem. The problem is that 4 to 5% of the population, something like that, is cluster B, that's the DSM-5 terms, histrionic, narcissistic, antisocial, psychopathic, or they have dark tetrad traits, they're Machiavellian, they're sadistic. That's about 4%. Okay, so the question is, how do these people maneuver? And the answer is, they go to where the...
You think he's spitting facts, or you think he's capping there?
I mean...
Like, you really think that...
So, let me just explain what the whole dark... tetrad or dark triad is.
I'm glad.
So this is a concept that, yeah, I researched it for the article because I think, you know, in writing about the article, I mean, his case is very lackluster in the end of the day. It's not even original because it's the exact same thing Doug Wilson does. But the appeal to the dark triad is a psychological concept. It was invented or published really in 2002. And it seeks to distinguish narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism into three distinct categories on a spectrum. So this spectrum's a triangle, thus the triad.
Can you kind of give the layman's definition of those terms? So narcissism, like, yeah, intense selfishness. The other one was...
psychopathy, or being a psychopath. So, and then the third one is Machiavellianism.
Yeah, at least define that one for the audience. That's more about power. Gravitating towards power and using it prudently and efficiently.
Yes, I do have my link toward up. Ironically, I'm using Wikipedia just as the shorthand. But narcissism is characterized by grandiosity, pride, egotism, and a lack of empathy. Machiavellianism is characterized by manipulativeness. Indifference to morality, lack of empathy, and a calculated focus on self-interest. And then psychopathy is characterized by continuous antisocial behavior, impulsivity, selfishness, callous and unemotional traits, and remorselessness. So that's the triad, and it's a spectrum. So where it becomes a tetrad, which means four, is when you include sadism. So you notice he did say the word sadistic, or he says they're sadistic. So sadism is the fourth, I guess, part of the spectrum that turns it from a triangle into a square. So it's kind of like, I won't say it's like the autism spectrum of like traits, but that's kind of what this is. So the common critique of this concept is that all three categories are roughly the same and there's not really much of a difference. So, you know, someone more Machiavellian, or are they a narcissist, or is it just all kind of just one characterization and you're just coming up with separate labels for the same thing?
That's what it sounds like when you're trying to combine that all into one person.
I mean, even when I'm just reading the Wikipedia page, yeah, a lot of the traits seem like they would have heavy overlap. And that's kind of the problem with this theory. Which, I mean, again, it's invented in 2002, so it's still kind of novel in the grand scheme of things. And just as a quick aside, again, I do mention this in the article, you will hear the dark triad used in a lot of red pill, like manosphere type circles, because they often will say that women are attracted to men who exhibit the dark triad traits, i.e. women like bad boys. They like guys that are dangerous.
But not the dark tetrad.
They don't like that. They don't like the nice guys. The nice guys finish last. That's because of women being attracted to the so-called dark triad traits.
Okay, so this term has...
It has a lot of circulation in certain...
And I've often called Jordan Peterson the daddy issues side of the red pill movement. So I guess there's some overlap.
The power is... And they adopt those ideas and they put themselves even on the forefront of that.
Right.
But the ideas are completely irrelevant.
Right.
All they're doing is they're the Pharisees. They're the modern version of the Pharisees. They're the people who use God's name in vain, right? As they proclaim moral virtue.
Yes.
Doesn't matter whether it's right or left or Christian or Jewish or Islam. They invade the idea space and then they use those ideas as false weapons to advance their narcissistic advantage.
Yes.
And so then you have the problem. And the right's going to face this more and more, particularly because the left had to face it when they were in powers.
Yes.
How do you identify the psychopathic parasites, 4% of the population, who are clothed in your clothing and right. waving your flags,
right.
but who are only in it for narcissistic benefit? You know, the people.
So, yeah, this made me think of Mitt Romney. Like, if anyone in politics kind of strikes me as a psychopath, I think it's more so people like Mitt Romney, the people who really have no principles, have no real ideas. They just want power. They want to stay in power, but they don't even want to do with it. And they're relatively good at campaigning. They don't care about lying and stuff like that. That is the ideologues, if you want to call them that. I don't think that's, I actually don't think the people on the far right are ideologues. And what I mean by that is they care more about action. They care more about courage than they do the finite minutiae of a theory or idea. The people who are ideologues are closer to the classical liberals, the libertarians.
Yeah, libertarianism is very ideological. So when you talk about a libertarian to right-wing pipeline, again, a lot of the people going to the right wing are coming out of a libertarian ideological phase.
Yeah, I would say
the ideology doesn't work.
I would say, you know, between now and 2022 when I ran for office, I am a lot less of an ideologue because I don't think we can just constitution our way out of it. I have a much more, my view of power is you can just do things, and majority of the people go with the winning side.
No,
go with the prevailing side.
I actually reject the notion that, you know, he's trying to suggest that a lot of people in politics, media, and theology or whatever, evangelicalism are actually, or religious institutions are psychopaths. I think that's entirely untrue. I think it's, you're overstating, I guess, the competency of these people. I mean, again, Donald Trump was able to dominate a crowded primary field in 2016 or 2015 because the people he was going up against were largely unimpressive people. Like, you put them in a room with an actual, I guess, the alpha male, so to speak, and they fall in line. They have they've never faced a guy like that before. It's kind of like
June 2015, Donald Trump went from eighth place to first place and never looked back.
Yes. Like, you put someone like that in those environments and they just dominate immediately because they've never actually encountered like actual competition. They've never actually had to like earn their way in there. They're just, you know, a lot of them are plants that got put in there because they had, you know, one donor that backed them. Maybe they're just like prostitutes for special interest. And yeah, that's how they stay in politics. It's like they're not these Machiavellians.
Right. Like, I don't think Trump is a psychopath just because he's a lot of things, but I don't think I think he genuinely cares about America. He genuinely cares about the American worker and the forgotten American. I think that's actually very genuine because that's kind of been his thing from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Actually, I would say John Kasich would be the closest thing to a psychopath in that race.
I don't even think they would be. They're just weasels. They're cunning. They're weasels. They're maybe manipulative. I don't even want to bother and say that they're psychopaths. I just think they're weasels. They hate their own base.
Yeah, you could accuse Trump of being narcissistic, perhaps, but he plays the art of the deal. That's his life.
I mean,
but as far as like politicians go, I'd say, yeah, I used Mitt Romney earlier. I think he's a psychopath. I think that's an example of a psychopath. Because he doesn't care, you know, he doesn't care that he blew the 2012 election. He didn't care. He's just still going to power through it. He has no shame about his what he does in politics. Carpetbagging in Utah to then run for Senate because he's a Mormon. He doesn't care.
I mean,
no,
if anything,
remorseless.
If anything, you had Machiavellian politicians in the past, but you certainly don't have that in the modern wave of politicians. I mean, the Democrats ran Kamala Harris, who literally got her start in politics by giving sexual favors. Like, she's not exactly a Machiavellian genius.
No, she might be a Machiavellian like tard, though.
I guess. I mean, if you call that failing upwards. But I mean, again, compare this era of journalists, this era of politicians, and this era of theologians to those of the past, and they don't hold a candle Like the journalists of the early 90s are far superior in their presentation and even the questions they would ask than the modern journalists. Like the journalists of the past would be called an anti-Semite. And I saw like this clip of Richard Nixon answering questions about, you know, ironically Jewish interests, and it was in the early 90s. And yeah, I mean, the journalists would be canceled for asking the question, let alone what Nixon says.
Right. So
people who studied the dark triad, these were people who originally studied psychopaths, and they moved into ordinary personality, so to speak, on the fringes. They showed that the non-criminal psychopaths, so the fringe cases, are Machiavellian. They use their language to manipulate. They're narcissistic. They want unearned reputation. That's what a narcissist wants. And they're psychopathic, which makes them predators or parasites. Okay, that's pretty bad, those three things. But they had to expand the nomenclature after a while because they found that they were also sadistic, which implied that if you're Machiavellian and narcissistic and psychopathic, you develop a sufficiently bad view of your fellow man that their undeserved pain is a source of pleasure to you. Mm. And that's what's being enabled online.
Yes.
Because we've evolved real specific mechanisms to keep such things under control in face-to-face interaction. Lack of anonymity, for example, within a community. Psychopaths in the real world, they wander. They have to move from place to place because people right. figure out who they are, and they're held responsible. They're particularly held responsible by men. But
I think he's capping there. Like, again, psychopaths are actually very successful in the business world.
Well, I mean, can we just talk about this is the attitude of, I don't actually talk to people in my audience when I go on the conference circuit, when I actually go out and meet people. I don't actually meet them. Because if you actually were in a room, like let's say any conference, the Right Response Conference, like I know there's a conference going on in Pennsylvania this weekend, and or just any like conference that would be called right wing, you're going to meet anons if you actually talk to the people that are attending the conference, that are actually in the crowd, not on the stage. You're going to meet actual anons, and you're not going to say, oh, they're a bunch of psychopaths. Like, that's someone that hasn't actually touched grass and met his audience. That's the only reason that you say that. And again, you know, Steve Dace, you kind of pointed out that example like 2 weeks ago of he was kind of in and out on the stage, whether that was, you know, a personal reason in his life or whatever. But he is someone that criticizes the anons and, you know, his behavior at the conference, however justifiable, reflects that. Like, people that bash anons have never actually talked to them. They've never actually met their audience.
Maybe they have, but they just don't care. They haven't in a while. So there's a bunker mentality.
Well, again, that's a touching, that's the whole touch grass thing.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's not, maybe not a never, but maybe just stop doing it. You're coasting. Which is why, let me just give a hot take right now. I want Steve Dace to run for governor of Iowa. I think he would do good at the job, or good enough at the job. And I think he would be forced to touch grass, which I think would be good. So he's got my support if he wants to run for governor of Iowa.
Now, we did overlook this part. What did you think about him saying that the Pharisees were narcissists?
I don't agree with that characterization. I don't think that's you maybe had a case if you're talking about the one guy who
Caiaphas
does,
or
no, not Caiaphas. When Jesus talks about in Matthew 6 about not being like the hypocrites who preach in the streets about how great they are. But I don't think I don't think that's
a, I mean, is that truly a 4 to 5% of the population characteristic trait though? Because, I mean, he makes it seem like it's this unique class of people. That's about 1 in 20. And I don't think the traits that he's talking about reflect only 1 in 20 in the population. Now, again, I don't actually think the Pharisees were psychopathic in their actions, even though, you know, the Jews that killed our Messiah, you know, pretty sadistic, one might say. But they really outsourced their sadism to the Romans, who probably did have their most sadistic people on crucifixion duty.
And Jesus asked the Father to forgive the Romans for their part in it because, yeah, they're just doing their jobs. It's kind of, you know, they're gambling for his clothes and stuff like that. And but they don't actually know they're killing the Son of God.
The
mob did.
Yeah, I mean, the Jews did, or at least Jesus told them up front, and that's why they they, you know, wanted him crucified, but they didn't actually care about the question so much. Like, they're mocking him. They're bringing in a show trial. They just want to kill him and find an excuse to kill him. Like, they view him, Jesus, as a competitor, as competition. So thus their behaviors reflect gatekeeping behaviors of they're going to find some means to undermine and being able to just throw him to the Romans. And they're not really as conniving. I mean, their biggest scheme was to lure was Judas going to them. Not even they went to Judas. So, I mean, you know, and they're
came
not
into really, their lap. Yeah, you're right.
They're not really these mastermind plotters, as even though they wanted to kill him.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Even at the mock trial they were throwing for Jesus, they couldn't even get their witnesses in a row. Like, they do it at night. So this is probably an invitation only type of event that they're bringing out these people to testify against Jesus, and they can't even find people to get their story straight.
But again, their entire interest was protecting their racketeering operation. They, you know, the Sadducees had control of the temple. They didn't want their money changing operations disrupted. They didn't want to, and the Pharisees didn't want to Messiah that looked like Jesus, pretty much. You know, they were kind of indifferent to the claims of Messiah until it was useful to kill him. Like, they, again, so the idea that they're uniquely psychopathic, I just don't buy. I mean, they're just people that preserve their own self-interest, you know, selfishly, out of greed, out of desire to be the influence. But, you know, a lot of them, you know, they didn't want anything that would rock the boat, which is all too commonplace nowadays.
Yeah, they're complacent. They want their gravy train, and I don't know if gravy's kosher or not. So,
I'm gonna, not if it has beef in it.
I have something for this. Anyway,
line they escape from that. They escape from that protective. They escape from that system of constraints, and they have free reign, and they can find other people like them very rapidly, and they can gang together. Yeah. So this is like, I can really see this starting to happen on the right. Like, I've been tracking
Okay. What's the history of psychopaths working together?
I mean, there's the movie Seven Psychopaths.
Okay.
But that's not exactly a serious answer.
Yeah, I don't think there is a... Like, is there any history of I mean, first of all, is psychopathy a real thing, or is it just a cultural idiom that we use? Like, is there actual a biological component to it, or is it just something that we say about people to describe their traits, because they're still people?
Psychopathic behavior on the right for probably 4 years, something like that, especially on the anti-Semitic side, because that's really where it reared its head first. And
why is that?
There's nothing more annoying than a successful minority. Right. Now, that's part of it. I might as well get myself in trouble right away, too.
Yeah, for sure. this is a real subject.
Well, it's a real terrible subject.
It's interesting because if you don't criticize it enough, you're compromised. If you criticize, you know, it's like when it comes to anti-Semitism, like, it's one of those things where you can't separate. It's a religion, and it's also a race, and it's also a government.
Mm-hmm.
That's where things get weird.
Right, right.
And then there's also the concept of intelligence agencies and compromise that also gets attached to it, the manipulation of world markets and money, and there's a lot to unpack. Mm-hmm. And then there's regular Jewish people who have nothing to do with that.
Well, the Jews, too, they're very successful.
Yeah.
And so what you would expect from a purely statistical point of view is you'd expect them to be overrepresented at the extremes.
They're also a walled garden, right?
Meaning
it's very difficult to join. They don't proselytize. They don't try to get you to join. Right. And they're all very tightly knit. They call themselves the Klan. They're all like locked in. Jewish Klan, not KKK. The problem with that term has been compromised by the Ku Klux Klan, you know, but I mean it as terms of tribe.
Well, community.
Yeah, community. Mm-hmm. They're very tight knit in that regard. You know, they stick together. Well, and if you understand the history, obviously, of Nazi Germany and of persecution in Eastern Europe, like, yeah, you have to. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well, all these complex things are multidimensional. I mean, you're...
Joe Rogan's more or less sounding pretty reasonable, and I'm not going to say he's a normie, because, you know,
he's
he had a conversation. he's Joe Rogan. He has conversations that normies are afraid to have, and he's sort of cutting edge in a lot of the conversations, you know, before the normies are having them. So
now,
Rogan's a normie, but again, he's someone that is more or less, I don't want to say a centrist, but he's not exactly on our side, but or anything like that, but he's gently pushing back on what
Peterson. I mean, yeah, Peterson is quick to just reduce it down to envy of the successful minority. Never mind the reasons why they're successful is that, you know, they have a strong in-group preference. And again, you know, they're disproportionately successful in certain industries. One of those industries is not necessarily military command, but they, yeah, obviously finance. So yeah, you're getting a lot of your people hired to industries like finance. So you're dominating law, medicine maybe. And yeah, you're getting a lot of your people into high paying, very materialistically successful careers. And again, a lot of these careers might do damage as well, especially when you're looking at the financial markets and, you know, certain medical experimentation. But he kind of sidesteps a lot of the question. Again, he basically says that, you know, it's psychopathic to that these people, he basically is trying to pathologize these people without getting into the substance of their actual claims, which is again, which is the entire point of pathologizing your opposition so that you can basically call them degenerates, call them immoral without disputing the claims that they're bringing forth.
So he talks about people being on the extremes of society. He says that the Jews are either on the extremes of being really successful or really bad, I guess, which is sort of what Doug Wilson once called a high performing people. And Doug Wilson said that, you know, I guess the magnitude of their achievements would be great, but the directions all over, directions a mixed bag, although I would say mostly a negative bag. But, you know, when you look at psychology and all the isms, except, you know, there, you know, was it
Dennis Prager? Dennis Prager quote, all the isms, but Nazism are
largely Jewish.
Yes.
So there's a lot of that.
But at the same time, you have a ethno-religion that, you know, does posit itself as having a superiority claim to other ethnicities and other religions.
Yeah exactly. They,
and regardless of whether, you know, they're atheistic or not, you know, they have that in-group preference. But even still, a lot of their atheistic presuppositions probably descend from those who were more devout in their religion who had a ethno-superiority.
Complex. Yeah, when Joe Rogan's talking about how it's difficult to define Jews because of the government, the people, the race of people, and the religion, you know, it's because there's one unifying factor, and that's a rejection of Christ. That is the only thing that defines a Jew in, you know, 2025, is a rejection of Christ.
And at the end of the day,
that's why you can be a secular Jew, and that's why, you know, you can still be obviously a religious Jew, and why they both still count as Jews.
And again, when one is attacked, they will generally band together, which is why you'll see even like Ben Shapiro teaming up with, you know, the ADL and Jonathan Greenblatt, despite their, you know, apparent rival. If you look at like a lot of their beef on social media and stuff, you know, they're both uttering the same talking points after 10/7.
So,
and
anyway, I was going to tie this back to things like psychopathy that he brings up, because if those people are also on the extreme edges of society, what are the odds that there's an overlap between these two populations that he's talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, he doesn't want to address the
question. He said that Jews were on the extreme ends of society.
Wouldn't they be disproportionately more disposed to that 4-5% under his claim? And again, if the other thing is he's suggesting that these Anons are going in for power, but, you know, if the Jews supposedly have all the power in the world, wouldn't the psychopaths be aligning themselves with the Jews in order to get to tap into that power structure that they so desperately want? So in other words, wouldn't they be the most rabid Zionists in the world because the Jews have all the power and
would you say that
for
Bibi
them
Netanyahu,
to get power?
Would you say that Bibi Netanyahu is a psychopath?
I mean, I would certainly say he's Machiavellian, but I wouldn't say Machiavellianism. Machiavellianism is psychopathy.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say.
I think he's an actual politician.
I am much
better. And he's an intelligence operative.
Sociopathy than I am psychopathy.
Like, the guy's an intelligence operative.
Right. So there's got to be some level of clinical indifference with that, I guess.
I watched your whole conversation with Douglas, and I thought you guys did a very credible job, all three of you, of navigating unbelievably choppy waters. So that's the first thing I'd like to say, because one of the things I was trying to figure out when I was watching that is, do I think I could have done a better job of any of you? And I certainly didn't walk away from it with that idea in mind. But then underneath all that, I thought there's a really unbelievably tricky problem here. And I think that's why it's made it poked up into, well, you also set that conversation up, but it poked up and made itself manifest in that conversation. And the issue is, how do you identify the psychopathic pretenders? And it's even worse now, and then make a barrier, right? Now, the right was calling for the left to do that for decades,
right?
And they didn't, and they couldn't. And the left is not good at drawing barriers, partly temperamentally. The right is somewhat better, but there's no shortage of monstrosity there. And so then the question is, how do you draw the line? And that's kind of what I was, because I've been watching these right-wing, they're not right-wing, these psychopathic types manipulate the edge of the conservative movement for their own gain.
Right.
And a lot of that's cloaked in anti-Semitic guise. There's plenty of anti-Semitism on the left, too, by the way. So it's not unique to the right.
Well, but particularly now.
Yes, particularly now.
Right.
And so, you know, you've let your curiosity guide you, your curiosity and your desire for knowledge, this quest, you've let that guide you as a podcaster. And I'm trying to work through exactly the same sort of thing. How do you know, given your radical increase in stature over the last 10 years, how do you know when your curiosity and even your skepticism about the fact that things aren't the way that people say they are, because that's certainly been demonstrated in the last 10 years, how should anyone decide what guardrails to put up? Like, what do you look for? Do you have a conceptual system worked out for that? Like,
what do you mean? In what way?
Well,
how do I look for in terms of people to talk to?
Yeah, because you have this insanely immense platform and you're inviting people onto it. And, you know, you said to Douglas, and I know this to be true, that you're not really thinking about the outcome exactly. You're thinking about, this is an interesting person to talk to, and I'd like to go on that quest. But then you have the additional conundrum. We're trying to work this out in the Daily Wire side of things, too. Not to say that that's exactly the same situation. It's like, once you gain in reach and authority, then how do you know that, how do you take great care that the people you're talking to aren't, what would you say, eliciting or feeding a subculture, yeah, that's right, that hasn't got the proper aims?
Mm.
Like, I guess the legacy media probably worked that out by having people, mediators, right, and guests, and that was also back when we could rely on the structures of authority in some sense to filter. And now we're...
No, there was never a time in his lifetime that you were able to rely on legacy media. Ever. Yeah,
I mean,
Walter Cronkite was a liar.
Yeah, I mean,
he lied about Vietnam.
Yeah, a lot of those, especially in the 60s. Yeah. I mean, there's an entire thing called Operation Mockingbird of the government, you know, manipulating the media.
No, when you had three channels, you were actually being fed a narrative.
I mean, that's, you know, when they talk about the boomers being propagandized like their entire lives, it's because they grew up with those three or four channels, and, you know, they believed what the TV told them. At least that's how a lot of the, you know,
and to be fair, Trump rode that. And, you know, the key to Trump's success was, though, he didn't steal the conservative vote. He stole Jeb Bush's vote, or would have been vote. So,
but you notice
he won the boomers because he was on the TV.
He does try to separate. Oh, well, there, you know, there's these bad actors. I mean, again, he doesn't necessarily refute or rebuff any of their claims. He basically says that they're bad actors without actually naming them. I mean, let's, for instance, take the fact that he's talking about someone named Nicholas Fuentes, you know, who may or may not be a homosexual, who may or may not be a federal agent, which, if he were, you know, that second thing, you know, that would explain why he is allowed to operate the way he's allowed to operate. But let's say he's talking about that. Would I say that his behavior is psychopathic or narcissistic? I mean, it might be flaming homosexual, but it's probably not, you know, psychopathic.
Okay, but how many gays aren't also narcissistic?
Yeah, I mean, that's it would be narcissistic by, you know, proxy. But, you know, you're talking about someone that's perhaps an opportunist and a contrarian. But again, when you take every single side of the issue, I mean, I guess that's how you kind of have an audience, where you're kind of half comedian, half newscaster, or so you brand yourself. So again, I don't necessarily think it lines with his claim. And we're talking about the worst actor. So I don't know who else you would be talking about. I mean, there's plenty of like e-girl grifters out there that are complete opportunists, but I don't think they're necessarily like Machiavellian players.
You don't think they're just, the dark triad that the Red Pill talked about was about men and
generally women. Speaking, yes.
But it's not talking about the women who are completely like this that ruin the dating market for good women out there.
I mean, yeah, you might say that about Andrew Tate if you wanted to be honest. Yes, he might qualify.
No, he'd be more of a sociopath, I think.
Or maybe when you add sadism in there, yeah, he might qualify on that level. But again, I don't necessarily think, okay, but does that necessarily negate any of the underlying truths of the things he says that are actually correct? No.
Yeah, and it's a strange instance of he's trying to label his opponents so he doesn't have to engage their arguments.
Yes.
And where have we seen this before?
But this is the classic leftist tactic.
Yes. This is what liberals do. This is not necessarily what the right is doing.
And again, I reject the fact that the right was calling out the left for having all these narcissists and sociopaths and, you know, Machiavellians or whatever.
He's Canadian, so I don't expect him to understand the history of American politics at all.
I mean, if anything, you had the neoconservatives doing that to the paleoconservatives.
Yeah, William F. Buckley, he was a villain, actually, going after people like Pat Buchanan and other people. So, yeah, there's a whole history of this. And that is his energy. That is, you know, same energy. How much more is left in this clip, by the way?
We might actually be done with the clip as far as its usefulness.
Okay, maybe I'll let it play out another minute.
We're in this helter-skelter world where everything is
the legacy media is the worst at that now.
Yeah, I know.
They're the worst
at
that, which is fascinating. You know, it really is. It's really fascinating when you lose faith in a New York Times piece. You know, it's like you go like, well, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
I know what they're doing. I know they're just, this is editorial bullshit. And that didn't used to be the case, I don't think.
But no, it didn't.
Yes, it was always the case. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean.
Come on, Joe. When was the next clip you wanted to show? That was at the 145 mark?
Yeah, so the 145 mark is kind of a good exhibit of Jordan Peterson's biblical teaching, which I think is kind of interesting.
It is worth covering here on Evangelical.
Because again, I mean, yeah, this is him talking about Moses and the burning bush, which I mean, gives you a good insight into how he exegetes the scriptures, which also kind of turns it into like a self-help manual.
So you kind of compared this pre-show, you compared this to Stephen Furtick.
Yeah, I kind of say that it's very narcissetical. So, you know, exegesis, like narcissistic exegesis or narcissesis is the term that's kind of been coined. I don't know who coined that.
Maybe it's Chris Roseborough of Pirate Christian Media, because, you know, I guess it's easy when you only go after that type of material. But yes, he coined it. Couldn't give him credit for it, even though, you know, he's crashed out.
Like, and if you want an example of someone that's probably got a very narcissistic personality in media, it would probably have been Jeremy Boring. Just to, like, if you wanted someone that I would probably say maybe qualifies, it would probably be someone like that, where he crashed a company because of his Hollywood vainglory.
Yeah, and it was Jason Whitlock who said that him calling himself the God King would affect his mentality and his self image.
So, I mean, again,
what was it that he called himself? Big Sexy?
Yeah, he used to call himself Big Sexy. So he, you know.
I had to bring that up because it's just so funny to me. Anyway.
So, yes, it does exist in media. But again, you're looking at the most obvious examples like Jeremy Boring or Andrew Tate.
Who punished those people? Actually, it was the far right, if anyone. Well, maybe not Andrew Tate as much on the far right, but I'm also not as convinced. You know, we can talk about who's taking Andrew Tate the most serious, but it's not exactly the Christian far right. There are other elements on the right that are taking Andrew Tate more seriously, but I don't think it's the Christian.
So we have someone saying that he's talking about Candace Owens, which again, I mean, I think Candace Owens is certainly crazy. I mean, I guess if you
say... She was always crazy, though. Let's be real.
I guess if you're saying she's histrionic, I mean, I could believe that, but I don't think she's Machiavellian or... No. I don't think she's some shrewd, callous actor.
Like when Brett Cooper left the Daily Wire, she probably had, she could make more money off of off platform than on plat on the Daily Wire. So she can make more money going independent. Candace Owens, like, nah, I think it was more of a risk for her, especially because she got fired for, you know, she got fired for going after Sacred Cows. She got fired for touching idols and trying to smash them. So, and, you know, I've never been a Candace Owens fan. If you've listened to me long enough, you've known that I have never liked her. And maybe I've complimented her at times, but... yeah, I've never been a fan, never listened to her. But she touched an idol and that was a no-no, but touching that idol could affect her ability to make money in this industry. So she actually took a risk there, and maybe it turns out she's still like what, top 15 in the industry.
Yeah. I mean, I think she's shrewd, but I don't think she's necessarily a Machiavellian or psychopath or
I don't know how she narcissist. Pulled that off. It's not as explainable to me as someone like Brett Cooper leaving or Matt Walsh. If he left the Daily Wire, he would just absolutely crush it and probably make more money unless they're very much overpaying him. So how did she pull that off? I don't know. Cause I don't think she's smarter than the other people I just mentioned or the other Daily Wire personalities. So,
but again, I don't think there's many people in the online right that necessarily fit the description Peterson's laying out. But again, we named three, and that's, you know, being generous by including Andrew Tate on the right.
Okay. What? Wait, who's the third? Andrew Tate, Candace Owens. Who's the third?
Oh, no, Candace Owens wouldn't. Oh, we discussed three of the people that they might have been. Jeremy, I guess between Jeremy Boring and.
Oh, well, Andrew you're Tate, saying he's an actual.
Yes.
I thought, you know, who Jordan Peterson.
Sorry, but we discussed. And then we have two names. Okay, so we discussed two names that would qualify and then two names that, you know, they're being perhaps subversively mentioned in this that are the subtext, but they probably don't qualify under the dark triad.
Yeah, I don't think Candace Owens is dark triad.
I don't think Fuentes is either.
Okay. He might be gay.
He might be narcissistic because he's gay, but I don't think he's allowed to exist.
When the person came to his house to break in and he pepper sprayed them, like that was, he could have done way more if he was sadistic. He could have baited that person into attacking him so he could cap them.
I mean, again, he's on tape saying, you know, storm the Capitol prior to January 6th. So, I mean, he's allowed to exist.
Yeah. I mean, so with that incident at his own house, he could have been like, touch me and see what happens and then, you know, end up stabbing someone, but he didn't. I don't think he's actually sadistic. But yeah, I think the other thing, and this is the whole thing about when we're trying to diagnose sins as personality disorders, when this is just sin nature manifest. Like, I don't think personality disorders are really a real thing. It's just sin. It's just a sin issue.
Or spiritual defect.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
spiritual malady. Like it's not something you can just psychologize. So let's get into narcissism, apparently.
Ah, please. All right. So this is the story that comes up at the beginning of Moses when he turns into a leader. So it's about how you turn into a leader. Okay. So he's already killed a man and he's left Egypt because of it. So now he's in this land called Midian, and he goes there and he chases some ruffians away from a well for these two girls who are drawing water. And they go and tell their father, and he says to them, bring this young man home to have dinner. So he does.
Okay, was he really young? But I guess in biblical days, 40 is young, right?
And then he gets married to them, and then he becomes a shepherd. And this is crucial because the shepherd's an image that runs through the biblical corpus, right? Well, shepherds at that time lived by themselves in the wilderness, on their wits, and they kept the wolves and the lions at bay with primitive weapons. So these were tough guys, and they cared for the most vulnerable. So a shepherd is an image of optimized ordinary masculinity. You take care of yourself, you can keep the monsters at bay, and you attend to the most vulnerable. So Moses has got that. He's a shepherd. He's a successful shepherd. So now he's out there one day wandering around Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai, or Mount Horeb, that's the place where heaven and earth touch. So that's where the messengers of the divine descend to earth. And so he's out there, and something attracts his attention, makes him curious. That's the burning bush. It's not a forest fire. It's not something you can't ignore. It's something alive, because that's a bush. A tree is a symbol of life. And it's burning because things that are alive burn, right? That's metabolism. And an intensification of that, like a psychedelic intensification of that, that's what the burning bush is. And that's what glimmers to Moses. And he steps off.
Okay.
I can't stand
listening to that nonsense.
I love how he's communicating with Joe Rogan and he says that the burning bush is a psychedelic. Like, that is just how, I guess that's the best evangelism method you could have possibly used.
But he's using
a very allegorical approach, as if it's he's indifferent to the claim of whether the story is true or not. He's just trying to, I guess, spiritualize every aspect of a story that isn't actually presented as spiritualization. It's actually presented as narrative, and it's presented as a phenomenon. Moses casually was, going about his business. He casually comes across this burning bush,
and then represents metabolism. What?
Yeah, it's burning because of. But again, it was burning, but it was not actually burning.
Being consumed, yeah.
So that's also another important. He's gonna talk about God in a moment, and then he'll only mention God maybe three sentences in, actually say God. But you kind of notice, oh, it's this mountain where the divine touched the earth, which I don't think it was Sinai where Moses saw the burning bush.
It was around the area. It might have been. Oh. I can't remember.
He's trying to almost overly spiritualize something that was more, again, naturalistic, but obviously a supernatural miracle. And he's trying to use this as Moses was a leader that then got promoted to a successful leader.
Was he a leader? I wouldn't say so. He was still underneath his father-in-law.
He's kind of just a working class guy, but okay. But the everyday man. Okay, fine. He's the average Joe. A successful average Joe in his daily life.
But, so he's a Bruce Willis of, Bruce Willis, in the wilderness.
Yeah. I guess that's where this is going.
Track, right? To investigate what drives his curiosity. And so then he goes off the beaten track and he starts to delve deeply into the mysteries of the burning bush. And at some point he realizes he's on sacred ground. He takes off his shoes. That's a symbol of willingness to transform identity, because shoes signify identity.
No, he was told to take off his shoes.
Yeah, he was told. But, he's trying to spiritualize every single element of the story.
Right? They're part of your costume, your working man's costume. And so then he continues to commune with the burning bush. He gets deeper and deeper into something. He makes himself a specialist by following what compels him and delving deeply into it. And when he gets deep enough into it, to the bottom, the voice of eternity speaks to him and says, you're now no longer who you were. You're now a leader. You have to go back to your people. You have to stand up against the tyrant. You have to tell the slaves that they need to leave their tyranny and their slavery and serve me in the wilderness. And you have to do that now. And Moses says, I can't, because I can't speak. I'm slow of tongue. And God says, basically, that's your problem. And with me on your side, we can sort that out. And don't you have a brother, Aaron? And can't he speak? It's bring him along for the ride. And so that.
Again, he mentions God only towards the end of that. But before that, it was basically
eternity.
He's on an epiphany. He's high on some psychedelics and he's having a trip. And the deeper he gets into his trip, finally eternity speaks to him. Not God speaks to him. He said eternity speaks to him. Which I understand, the whole I am thing is a reference to God's eternal nature, but that's probably not where Jordan Peterson's head is at when he's making this.
No, because what does God say to Moses? Who made man and who formed his tongue or something like that? So God goes back to creation when Moses brings up that, that weak sauce excuse of I can't speak. God just says, who made man?
And again,
I have a brother, until Moses had a second objection to that. And because God was not willing to give Moses an excuse. Moses, to some degree, was, a little bit dragged, kicking and screaming. But it did seem that, Moses and Aaron at least had some communications and stuff. So Aaron was on his way or whatever, maybe God prompted Aaron to go out. Either way, you just totally removed the creation element from that story.
I mean, again, a lot of Moses's story is his how he identifies with his own people. Because, again, he doesn't necessarily identify with his own people in 100% totality until he intercedes for them before God on Sinai. So at this point in the story, he doesn't really identify as, you know, a fellow Israelite. He's just a fugitive on the run. And, you know, the brief moment where he tried to protect one of his own, he was then rejected by them. And even while living in Midian, he doesn't circumcise his children, and he does, you know, he still doesn't necessarily identify with the Israelites until he intercedes for them on Sinai. So that's part of the arc of Moses as a character, but, you know, Jordan Peterson's not necessarily going to go into that, because that you know, that's kind of a nationalistic, you know, identifying with your nation is part of Moses's development.
And he lives in Canada. And who wants to identify? No, I'm just kidding.
That's when Moses becomes a leader, right? And so that's the pattern. It's like ordinary masculinity. Those are the dwarves that Snow White serves before she meets the prince, by the way, the ordinary masculine, right? So, and those dwarves protect her from the evil queen that wants to suppress her by feeding her a poisoned apple. So Snow White has to learn to serve the ordinary man before she can find a prince. Yeah, something Disney missed completely in the last story. So,
I'll agree with him.
What's the
that
pattern?
Point.
Well, you discipline yourself so you become a shepherd, and then you follow what compels you off the path. Then you take it seriously and get to the bottom of it, and then that transforms you. And thus transformed, you can face the tyrant. Mm. You can specify the promised land properly, and you can lead the slaves.
What do you mean specify the promised land properly? That was God who did that. Anyway.
Cross chaos and blood, that's the Red Sea, and then through the desert. Right. And so you said two things. You said that the good fighters have learned to integrate their civilized side. Otherwise, they don't get to be great, and that they continue the pathway of self-improvement. Right. They continue to pursue what's calling to them. That's another definition of God in the Old Testament, by the way. What calls to you? That's the burning bush. The spirit of the burning bush is what entices you, what grabs your interest, what attracts your curiosity. And that's identical. The biblical claim is that's the same thing as the spirit of adventure. It's the same thing that speaks to Noah. Noah's a good man. And a voice comes to him and says, all hell's about to break loose. And he believes his intuition because he's a good man and can rely on himself. So he makes the ark, right? And he brings his family aboard and culture and nature and reestablishes humanity. That's the pathway of the leader.
We're calling obedience intuition.
Well, again, he's trying to essentially turn each of this into like the hero's journey or the Odyssey. Or something, even though the Bible's more interesting than such stories. But I mean, again, Moses already had a lot of the natural traits that would have engendered him for leadership. I mean, he was highborn.
Yeah,
he's highborn. He's already educated. He probably had martial training, which is, you know, he goes out and leads the Israelites in battle later on. So he is himself very developed as a person. Again, he doesn't necessarily identify with his own people, and he has struggles with that. But I mean, other than that, he is very much kind of a decent packaging as far as who would God choose.
And
minus the whole fugitive part.
Faces Pharaoh, but God told him what would happen, then it happened. So it's obedience. It's not intuition. It wasn't Moses going, let me be Spartacus. It wasn't like that at all.
I mean, if anything, he was very reluctant.
He's a reluctant leader, and that's what you see a lot of times in scripture. I'll use Gideon as an example of someone who's kind of cowardly, and then God uses and forces him to anyway be, you know, a judge, and judges were basically kings, so which is why I think when they chose Saul, it's more about they're rejecting the king that God has appointed.
I mean, functionally, Samuel.
The judges were kings, and you know that's especially true in the Gideon story, where he was a king, had 70 children, and you know that had the most famous succession—not the most famous succession crisis in all the Bible, because I think a lot of Christian normies don't know the story of Abimelech because that's not in your Sunday school class. But anyway.
Oh, let me just answer this. So, yeah, with regards to Snow White, I mean, a lot of the Disney archetypes are very like feminine. Feminist coded. I mean, Beauty and the Beast is probably the most obvious example because Belle is a very disobedient daughter. She is very, she's very much a bad citizen of her community. And she, you know, goes out of her way to incarcerate herself into the immoral hands of the Beast, who again is a, you know, crappy person.
That's why he's a beast in the first place.
Yes, that's why he's cursed in the first place. But because he doesn't understand or respect, you know, the principles of hospitality.
Oh, wait, and, but, noblesse but oblige.
Yeah,
noblesse oblige.
And, you know, it's kind of like how Gaston is the natural hero of the story because he's a protector of his community and natural leader of his community. But the movie goes out of their way to villainize him. With regards to Snow White, Peterson's point is that she's learning to be a servant to ordinary men before she can be a servant to her husband. So it's, you know, it's kind of like the woman's role is to be the helpmate. And, you know, that is exemplified in the life of Snow White prior to her being married. That's, you know, part perhaps even the qualities that make her the fairest of them all. So, I mean, he is, you know, kind of refuting the basic, I mean, these are probably basic critiques of a lot of the Disney princesses because they're very feminist coded.
I mean, like Elsa is probably the most obvious other than maybe Belle, because she's the villain in the entire story. And then there's just no consequences because you're going to, either way, like in the weasel guy in that movie is actually everything he does is completely rational, but he's made out to be the bad guy. I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, again, you can, using like a Jungian or any sort of archetypal criticisms, yes, you can have a field day with a lot of the Disney films.
Oh, for sure. But
which, again, the problem is Peterson then uses those exact same, hermeneutical approaches and then applies them to scripture. You know, the shoe is, the sign of him being a working man when it's probably because he's not supposed to tread dirt.
It's not Cinderella
into the holy ground.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Peter, too.
What is your take on, there's a university in Jerusalem that had this theory that the burning bush was the acacia bush. Yeah. The acacia bush is rich in DMT.
Well, I think, I think that hallucinogens strip memory from perception. So you see the world in all its blazing glory. Huxley figured that out with the doors of perception. That's really apparently what psychedelics do psychopharmacologically. They mimic it.
That would be a Jewish interpretation of the Old Testament. The University of Jerusalem he cited. It's like, yeah, they would try to undermine that story that way. Anyway.
They mimic a high stress condition and they strip memory from perception so that you can return to the source and revitalize your perceptions. Right. So the probability that there's some overlap between that and the burning bush is high. It's high, so to speak. High. Yeah. So
there you have Jordan Peterson denying or basically saying that this was a DMT trip that Moses was on. Or there was a very high percentage chance that this was a DMT trip.
Yeah. I mean, again, he's basically saying he was on a psychedelic trip and that's how he got the calling to go rescue his people from.
Wow. Like even Tim Keller isn't that liberal. Was Karl Barth even this liberal? Like this is very bad theology. And yet he's given a lot of credibility.
I imagine the science on psychedelics came a little bit after their time. Well, Karl Barth's time.
Oh, for
yeah.
Sure.
If they knew about MK Ultra, they probably would have said it, but yeah, I mean, and that's probably the end of that clip. I mean, I'm sure he does it throughout the other clips because I think he does talk about other clips. But I mean, that's kind of a good encapsulation of like a lot of the flaws of Jordan Peterson as a biblical teacher. I mean, he more or less denies the accuracy of the text to basically say what he wants it to say. And then he makes the story about the audience in a sense, rather than the story about God, Christ, or even just the character in the story. You are the character in the story. So he's essentially transposing his audience into the story.
I mean, Moses, I'm not going to say he didn't do anything. He was a friend of God. He was obedient until he struck the rock for the most part, right? But God did pretty much all the heavy lifting. Can we at least acknowledge that about the story, Jordan Peterson? God did the heavy lifting? Is that so hard? Or we got to say that, yeah, there's a high percentage chance that this was an acacia bush and he was on a DMT, which I'm a believer in, you know, the psychedelics are you know, they have some spiritual impact on people. I'm a believer in that. But I don't think that spiritual impact is good. So let's get back to it.
Because well, I mean, this might here, be right? the, this might be the end of the clip and then it transitions.
Okay.
So I'll tell you one more thing, one more story, okay, if that's all right with you.
Okay.
So something else I figured out that I tried on Brett. So imagine you could take the hedonistic path, you could take the power path, you could take the nihilistic path, okay? And then you might say, well, that's the only three options. That's kind of what the postmodernists believe. That's kind of what the nihilists and the postmodernists, the Nietzscheans believe. Power, hedonism, nihilism, those are your options. There's no uniting narrative above that. Okay, so in the story of Cain and Abel,
oh boy, we got another
two
one.
Patterns are laid out that are different than that. One is Cain's pattern, one's Abel's pattern. So these are the first two people that live in the world, right? Because Adam and Eve are made by God. They're in paradise or were. Cain and Abel are the first two people. So Abel brings his best to the table. So he takes the best animal in his flock and he takes the best cut and the best part of the cut and he offers that to God. So he literally brings his best to the table. That's what he sacrifices. And Cain doesn't. So Cain's sacrifices are rejected by God. And God tells him, if you brought your best to the table, you'd be accepted. And
that's not what he was told.
Yeah, I mean, it was expected that it was supposed to be a blood sacrifice. And so, I mean, even if he bought the first fruits of his labor, that would not have sufficed.
Well, I don't even think it goes that far. I mean, I think it's really about if you are unregenerate, your works don't matter.
No, that too.
Is
I mean, that undergirds why he, you know, was very flippant with the offering.
Yes. So, well, again, and then he's later told that, you know, you need to check your sin or it will find you out, which is what, you know, so God, you know, when God's warning him before he kills Abel. So when he talks about, first of all, Adam and Eve weren't there. Yes, they were. There's no indication that they were dead.
Yeah, I mean, they're not dead, obviously.
And then Seth.
Well, I mean, he's saying that Adam and Eve were created rather than born. So I guess that's one way that's, I guess, the generous way to interpret it. But I mean, technically, you know, I guess the dark thing about Cain and Abel is that this is the first human death in the history is so, a homicide rather than.
It's like what Stormy Squad is saying. It's like Cain's sacrifice wasn't offered in faith. So to me, I understand the blood part because there is that correlation that there was an expectation from the Garden of Eden that, you know, because God killed the animals and as a fur for clothes and stuff like that. So that's where people gather that blood sacrifice was an expectation. But even regardless of that, he wasn't faithful. He was unfaithful. He was unregenerate. So no sacrifice, even if he did make a blood sacrifice, it would never have been accepted. But he didn't make the proper sacrifice because he wasn't faithful. So, you know, it's both ways, but I think, you know, the unregeneration precedes his lack of faithful sacrifice. There we go. Some people might not like that one. There, a little Easter egg there for theology. Were you going to say something else on that?
No, I'm not. We're flying blind on this part. I'm not too familiar.
Okay,
with this.
You're not familiar with him getting this story wrong.
Cain, I mean, I know he's got it wrong in the past.
And invites temptation in to possess him. So that spirit of resentment possesses him. And then he becomes murderous. He kills his brother and his descendants become genocidal. And then you have the flood. And so that pattern of sacrifice is established right at the beginning of the biblical texts. Abel versus Cain. Abel brings the best to the table. And that satisfies God. So one quest. God actually asks Cain this when Cain complains. He says, wouldn't you be accepted if you were doing your best? And so that's a question of conscience, right? If you're in extreme misery and your life is hollow and empty and you're bitter and resentful, it's like, you bringing your best to the table? Because the covenant proclaims that if you did, you'd be accepted.
Yeah,
so
clearly.
Okay, so now the question is, what constitutes, now you know you have to sacrifice. So sacrifice becomes the foundation of the state, not power, not hedonism, it's sacrifice. And then that motif is played out through the whole Bible, and that's what culminates in the New Testament, right? Total sacrifice as the foundation of the community. And that's right. And like, I don't know what sense to make out of the metaphysics of the religious realm, you know, because that's beyond me and everyone. The world's a strange place, and we could leave it at that. But the idea that...
No.
Notice how he makes it about sacrificing towards the community. So again, he does take it to a very collectivist direction. And this is not the first time he's made those kinds of statements on Cain and Abel.
This is worse than Joel Osteen.
I mean, this is, again, he's turning it into essentially a socialistic or statist. The sacrifice is essentially your tax.
Like, at least Joel Osteen gives more glory to God than this guy.
I mean, again, the way he even quotes, "This is what God said," is very,
very,
let's just say,
loose.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you were bringing your best, you'd be accepted. No, the whole point is our best isn't good enough. The whole point is we're not enough. Our works are filthy rags. That's the whole point. Like, again, name a false teacher nowadays. Like, is Paula White this bad? I should point this way because how it appears. Is she that bad? Because I don't think she is. So.
Yeah, I mean, again, he kind of gets a huge pass because of a lot of his reputation that precedes him.
Right. He's an atheist that's curious. He's so close to the faith, God. Have you listened to him talk about scripture? This guy removes and secularizes the book so much. And then he spiritualizes. You pointed out that he spiritualizes it, which I think is actually a little too kind.
Yeah, I mean,
he allegorizes it. That's a much better
way. I guess symbolizes might be, you know, he
allegorizes the text. He's not actually spiritualizing it because he's taking spirituality out of the text. And he's putting anthropology into it. He's not actually, so name a false teacher that's worse than this on the Bible. That's a genuine challenge.
But I mean, it's bad, but it's also maybe convincing if someone is completely ignorant.
Yeah, and then they read the text and like, what is this guy talking about?
Or they listen to an actual preacher.
Like, even John Hagee's got to be more convincing than this. Or got to be better than this on exegesis.
See, Christ is the exemplar of voluntary self-sacrifice, right? Won't turn to power, won't deviate from his course, faces the worst of all possible deaths, descends to hell itself. That's the pattern of life lived with no reserve. And that's the foundation of the free state. That's right. I tried that on Brett. Hey, he told me when we first met on the tour that he felt that the biblical narratives were anachronistic, you know, that they were written in a time that was no longer relevant to us. But he decided by the end of our 3 days together that if you got to the core of the message, it's alive. Right, that's the living spirit inside the bush, you might say.
Right.
And that it's, so here's even the weirder thing. So imagine, it's pretty obvious that Christ is a symbol of voluntary self-sacrifice. Right? I don't think, it doesn't really come as a shock to anyone. But the weird thing.
No, Christ is God. It's pretty clear in the scripture that he's that. He's not a symbol.
Thing is, you know, we put that symbol at the center of our churches and at the centers of our towns for 2,000 years, not really knowing why. And the reason is that voluntary self-sacrifice is the foundation of the integrated psyche and the stable, productive, and abundant community. And that's right. It's right. And so, well, it's been exciting to have the opportunity over the last 9 months to go talk to people about that, because I've talked.
No, again, he's saying it's all about.
Paid to talk about that.
Again, that's a very man-centric view. You know, Christ's sacrifice was for the betterment of this life now, not necessarily, you know, your reconciliation with God. Because again, I mean, you know, the immediate effect of the sacrifice isn't necessarily, you know, earthly benefit or social society. Those things come because of, you know, Christ rising from the dead and basically being the king. You know, Christ being king, you know, Christ is king, that hate speech line that Jordan Peterson loves so much. Like, that's where the peace comes from. That's where the government is upon his shoulders comes from. You know, where a lot of the outflow of societal benefits or the water flowing from Jerusalem comes from. But that it's not in and of itself like this notion that, you know, if we just, like, he is making it about this is how we have a functioning society, irrespective of whether the events are true or not.
Like, and even the functioning society part isn't really accurate at all because it's just psychobabble.
I mean, again, if you really want to have a functioning society, I mean, yeah, patriarchy.
A strong probably, man ruler.
Yeah.
That takes care of business.
Which, again, I mean,
fights off the giants or whatever.
You know, the people that have agency are the ones that make the decisions. You know, virtuous population, actually having an aristocracy and people that have, you know, obviously since the Pareto principle is true.
The what?
You know, the Pareto principle of like, you know, 80% of the capital being probably in the hands of 20%. You know, that is kind of more or less natural. And again, having a strong aristocracy is actually good for the functioning of a society and a safeguard against tyranny.
And one of the things that I'm actually excited about is I think we're developing, you know, I coined the term on the one live stream, but I'm going to use it again, a new Christian elite. And that's what I'm seeing now. I'm talking, when I went to the conference at the beginning of the month, you know, I met some movers and shakers, met some wealthy people on the right, and it's like we got a new Christian elite forming here, and we're at the beginning stages, because you know wealth tends to compound because of that's how investment works. But anyway, that, and this is what's necessary before, you know, any what's the way to put it, you know, you need to have a cultivated elite, and then we can have more, you know, power in society. And you get that by, you know, patroning your own in a way. So
I don't know if we wanted to
shift. An allusion to the Roman patristic system. We can do last call for questions. And I saw a couple questions and comments in the chat that I wanted to get to. Let me take care of the super chat here. There's two super chats. So Candace Owens married a guy worth 150 million. Really? He's that rich? Why doesn't she ever seem happy? I wish I knew the answer. But
I mean, I think she's a little on the crazy side, but that might answer your question. I mean, at the end of the day, she's a woman that's, you know, makes her money on the internet in front of a camera. And, you know,
a recipe for happiness.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. Well, I think there's exceptions. I'll just say that. And then we got, so thank you, Nobody's Special. And we got the Bishop of the Railway. $5 Canadian. Didn't dislike my Canadian slight enough. But, you know, a bastard's lineage could not serve for 10 generations. David is 11th from Judah and Tamar. Well, that's interesting to put it that way, but I don't think that counted as an illegitimate child because that was his daughter-in-law that was kept in the line of Christ. So I think that would be my read on that. Like, I don't think that counts as illegitimate, and I don't think that Jesse and onward up to that were considered illegitimate in the line of David. And I don't believe that Jesus has any illegitimacy in his patrilineal lineage, or the one from Mary, for what it's worth. So I don't think there's any illegitimacy in either of those lineages. That's just my thoughts.
I mean, I thought the 10 generations was Moab being reconciled back into the people on the 10th generation.
Yeah, but he's referring to, was it
Judah? I know, but I thought I didn't think it applied to Judah and Tamar. I thought it was Moab being reconciled through Ruth.
Yes, that part is true.
So that's where I would see the 10 generations, not Judah and Tamar.
Okay. All right, we got Spanish Baptist getting controversial on me. I was thinking about writing a paywall article on this. Because I like both sides of this conflict and I don't want to see it happen. So those are kind of my thoughts, as I'm sad. Like, why can't we just get along?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm just going to read what Stephen Wolf said at first and just say the people to the inch, an inch to your right, and those to an inch to your left are not destroying your country. Direct your righteous anger elsewhere. If you have problems with someone, keep it in private channels. And I think both sides in this conflict are violating this basic principle. The last thing we can do at this point, or we should be doing at this point, is purity spiraling. We don't need to counter signal each other. We don't need to purity spiral. There's enough Joel Berries. There's enough Eli McGowans. There's enough, you know, bad James Lindsays that you can go after without going after each other. I mean, it's ridiculous. There's not enough of us. And, you know, we're just proving the papist right. And this is why we need a guy like Donald Trump in the White House, because you have all these people that don't know how to act and are attacking each other over minor disagreements, like versus Trump and, you know, a lot of these, even like the J.D. Vance, that can kind of be above all the fray, because a lot of these people can't get their act together.
Yeah. Now, and I think that's the part where we're going to see a shift in, because, you know, you got, I'll use Joe Webbin and William Wolf as two examples of this. William Wolf is someone who's actually willing to play and win the game of politics. He was on the ground in Colorado fighting the transgenderism bill there, by the way, trying to stop, you know, because if that bill passes the Senate in Colorado, it's going to go to a gay Jewish governor who's going to sign a bill that will pretty much authorize a family court to take away children from their parents and stuff like that. So, yeah, good luck convincing the governor to veto that one.
And again, you see how William Wolf conducts himself online. He doesn't necessarily counter signal those on the right. He's focused on his mission, and he's a fine example to follow.
And then I'll say Joel Webbin for being willing to build coalitions of people that the reformed world just won't do. So I'll use that as another example, because he's willing to build bridges, build coalitions, and branch out. Like even tonight, you know, he's getting into conservative media dissident conservative media, I should say, not conservative Inc.
So, now again, if you want to go after the Groypers, okay, go after the Groypers by name. I mean, you know, Nick Fuentes just, you know, had Kanye West back this week for admitting to doing some weird acts that, you know, I don't necessarily want to describe. But yeah, I mean, you know, you can go after them for that. I mean, you know, I already alluded to Fuentes being a homosexual, and then Kanye West doing other, you know, sodomitical acts. And, you know, maybe there's something there.
Maybe Sam Holden shouldn't have used John Harris in his video back last summer, but I couldn't care less about that, about my face being used in a video like that, because who cares? You know, they're going to call you every name in the book anyway, so you might as well embrace it. And I don't think anti-Semitism on the right is going to call. I don't think when we have internal conversations about it, or even public conversations about anti-Semitism, that's going to affect us. I do think, you know, if you're running for office, you know, do keep that to yourself for a bit.
Yeah, play your cards right.
Even a famous mustache man didn't do that in his public speeches. He did it in his party speeches. So, like, if even Mustache Man didn't do that,
there is a sense that we need to understand optics. Again, this goes for both sides in this dispute. Obviously, I do think Jewspurging is a problem. Yes, there's not a Jew underneath every rock. And if you're like me, I mean, I talk about other groups of people way more than I talk about them. In fact, I rarely, if ever, talk about them. I talk more about, you know, women and, you know, Black people, especially with the recent issues, than I ever do about the groups associated with Israel. But there's plenty of people you can go after. And again, on the flip side, again, when this would be Joseph Spurgeon, who did the counter Antioch Declaration.
The Antioch Declaration light, which I thought was just trash.
Again, that is a stupid decision optically, because again, when your opponents make a mistake, let them.
Yeah, there's a famous Napoleon quote when he defeated the Russian army and near Kaliningrad or something like that. He's like, yeah, we're not going to find our enemies making this mistake twice, you know, because they basically crossed the river and, you know, they were trapped against the river. So their backs were to the wall. So Napoleon just smashed right through their line and captured their bridgehead so they couldn't retreat and just smashed the Russians. So yeah, you're not going to see, is Doug Wilson going to make the mistake of the Antioch Declaration twice? I don't know, but don't give him a lifeboat of legitimacy when he's making a mistake like that.
Exactly.
And John Harris did participate in that. I disagree.
And Joel, and again, Joel did too, which that was also.
They did it as a complete courtesy, though.
Yes.
But they didn't really endorse it beyond that. So I mean, they did it as a courtesy and said it was a courtesy and nothing more, and then did nothing a bit, and they don't really defend it since. But yeah, yeah. I disagree with John Harris on that. He's a friend of the channel.
Again, I like both sides. I say this, you know, with kindness that, you know, don't, again, both sides in this specific conflict need to work on their optics. And again, the mission is defeating these leftists. Again, not, you know, policing our own. Again, and John Harris did make a mistake when he said, you know, the ranks within, I will control the order, I will control the order within our ranks. I'll pull it up in a second, which again does rub off the wrong way because you're assuming that you have rank within the order.
I think he has a lot of credibility. Like,
I think he does, but I mean, I do think that was a poorly worded statement that rubs people the wrong way.
I mean, I still think John Harris is on our side. I don't think there's any.
Yeah, we will keep order in the ranks. Again, that's a statement that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. It
necessitates hierarchy, but
it also assumes that your place in the hierarchy.
I believe John Harris should have a place in the hierarchy.
I'm not saying he shouldn't. I'm just saying you.
But
is that assuming you're a little higher than you actually ought to assume yourself? Again, you want to be exalted to the. You want to be the person being exalted higher, not the person being exalted lower or unexalted.
So I don't know. I don't know much about the John Harris Holden brothers. I mean, I said what I knew about the whole video thing, but I don't know the other beef around that to weigh in on it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll just leave it there. I mean, again, both sides work on your optics.
Yeah, and I just want
we don't need the counter signal. We don't need the purity spiral.
Yeah, and I don't think anti-Semitism actually kills the movement at all.
All the tailwinds are on your side on that issue.
Yeah. We've already won the next generation. Who cares? I'm not looking for boomer approval. I'm not looking for Gen X approval. I think Gen X is actually going to get skipped. They're the most important voting block for the Republican Party. But when I say they're going to get skipped, like, we're going to have a millennial president before we have a Gen X president. Because J.D. Vance, I think, is our next president. If that wasn't implied enough. So, and I don't think I think the Democrats will run a millennial as well, probably. Maybe they run Stephen A. Smith. Doubt it, though. Awesome. Any more questions? That was a long one. Spanish Baptist trying to get me into some trouble here. But, you know, again, I want to be friends. Friends with both sides.
It's an honest question. You're asking
me to weigh in. It's a good faith question. Trying to get me in trouble. But yeah, actually, I guess the biggest area of disagreement I have with him this week is on the Jeff Metcalf situation. No respect for that guy. Anyway, looks like that's it.
Yep. Check out the article when that comes out. Because I go a little bit deeper into, again, I guess Peterson's strategy and, you know, just the nature of psychologizing of opposition. And basically, you know, that's kind of how you create the whole longhouse and you maintain the so-called post-war consensus is through psychology.
Yeah, if you compare everything to Hitler, then everything bad is Hitler-esque. And, yeah, you don't even have to address arguments if you just call him Hitler. Where have we seen that before? So. If you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channel, to the podcast, if you're new. Check out Winning Not Winsome. That's my book. We also have a patron-like system at Evangelical Dark Web. That's linked in the description below as well. Have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, You save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.